This recording is a production of Faith Builders Resource Group. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Conference 2022, held at Faith Builders from August 7 to 9.
Welcome, everyone. We'll get started here. Talking about creating confident writers is probably rather an ambitious thing to try to do in an hour, so we'll use all the time we've got. This is Luke. Luke is generally a good student. He especially likes math, and he's very good at it. But when it comes to writing, Luke struggles. Everyone else seems to understand the assignment and have things to write about, but Luke's mind seems to be one big blank. The minutes tick by, and no matter what you as a teacher do to help him, he just stares at the blank page all class long. This is Madison. Madison is a hardworking student who aims to please. But when it comes to writing class, she can never seem to think of enough to say. Unlike Luke, she writes something, but it's way too short, the writing feels stilted, and if we're honest, it's pretty boring. This is Sophia. Sophia struggles to enjoy some parts of school, especially sports. But when it comes to writing class, she comes alive. Her pencil flies across the page, and she creates wonderful, well-written, original work. She is a confident, creative writer. So I'm curious, how many of you have experienced some version of these students in your classroom before? Seeing lots of hands, right? And when you've experienced this range, you can't help but wonder, why can't all students be like Sophia, right? What causes the Lukes and the Madisons, and more importantly, how can we help them? So that's what we're going to aim to discover in this session. And if you came here hoping for easy answers with a nice three-step formula to make it all better, you're going to be disappointed. Like most things in teaching, the answers aren't simple or one size fits all. But that being said, there are things that we as teachers can do to help our students become more confident and successful in their writing. And my aim is to give you some tools that will help you navigate some of these issues. Sometimes writing struggles are because of an issue with our students, with what's going on inside of them. And we're going to talk about what might be causing the writing struggles in Luke and Madison. Now, of course, just being informed about the issues is not automatically going to solve them, right? But I think it's such an important first step. We're going to struggle greatly to solve problems if we don't even know what the problems are in the first place. And then other times, I think the issues are not so much things that are going on with our students, but it's things that we as teachers can control to lessen these problems in our classrooms. Now, I don't at all intend to imply that all of our students' writing struggles are our fault. That is just untrue and unhelpful. But we do have a part to play, and so I think we'd be remiss to not discuss the things that we can do to help work with our students and make writing easier for them. So I've chosen three kind of large overarching issues that may be keeping our students from being able to write with confidence. The neurological difficulty of the task, fear or perfectionism, and a lack of structure in our writing classes. On your handout, you can see I've kind of laid out those three headings along with a brief outline of what I'm going to be talking about. And I hope to give you lots of practical ideas and tips that you can take home to your classroom. However, I recognize that depending on your unique situation with your unique writing classes and your unique students, not everything I say will be helpful for you. So that's kind of why I just left this side one big blank for you to jot down whatever is going to be most helpful for you to remember and take home with you. So let's get started. A huge issue facing children as they write is simply the neurological difficulty of the task, or just all the hard stuff our brains have to do while we're writing. Writing is hard work for anyone, but especially for children. So think about all the parts of the brain that need to be involved for a child to write a story. They need to be using the motor areas that help them physically hold a pencil and write words on the page. They need to be activating the part of the brain that stores grammar and spelling rules, planning ahead and making decisions, generating creative ideas, using their concentration skills to focus on the task at hand, imagining and visualizing what they're creating, retrieving facts or memories from long-term storage, putting thoughts into words through the Language Production Center, and using their reading comprehension skills to understand what they've already written. And so when you think of it that way, it's kind of a miracle that any of us can write at all. There's just so much going on. And writing is, neurologically speaking, one of the hardest tasks you will ever ask your students to do. And so if we as teachers can cut back on how many of these neurological tasks they need to do at the same time, it can help to make writing easier for them. So how do we do that? Well, I think sometimes there's some expectations that we as teachers can have for our students while writing that can accidentally make this problem worse. Of course, we'd never try to do something that would make writing harder, but sometimes we forget what it's like to be in their shoes because it's been a while since we've been in their shoes. So, for example, at my school in general, we have a rule that students above a certain age need to write in cursive for everything that they do. Now, for most kids, that's not a problem. But for some children, the simple act of forming cursive letters takes so much mental energy that they don't have any energy left for the actual writing. So this is one thing. In my classroom, we lift that rule when we're writing a rough draft. So they're always allowed to choose between printing and cursive when they're writing their first draft. And it's one small thing that can just simplify this process for them. Or some students struggle so much just with handwriting in general, whether it be cursive or printing, that it just takes all their mental energy to actually write words on a page. So this isn't always a viable solution depending on your setting, but I'll mention it in case it would work for some of you. If you have access to computers or tablets with a talk-to-text feature, that can be a really helpful way of just removing this piece for a child, let them speak their writing. Or if you have a teacher's aide who could be available for them to dictate to, again, we're removing the barrier that keeps them from being able to write well, or keeps them from being able to focus on the rest of writing. Another rule I have when they're writing their first drafts is that they're not allowed to ask me questions about grammar or spelling. Some students have to put so much energy into just how to spell words that, again, it takes all their mental energy and they don't have anything left for all the rest of these tasks. So if a student asks me how to spell something, I just say, sound it out for now, you'll know what you mean, and we can fix it later. It might seem like, as teachers, we should be insisting on correct grammar and spelling all the time. Won't it give them sloppy habits if we don't require them to write correctly? But my opinion is that it's okay. Like, that's what editing and revision is for. And while writing a rough draft, they shouldn't need to worry about it, and especially not at the expense of the flow of writing. It's such a pet peeve of mine if a kid stops writing and waits and waits and waits and waits for me, and I come to them, how do you spell ready? Like, oh no, like you need to be writing, guys, right? Like, it's just that's not what their focus should be in that moment. Their focus should be getting their thoughts down. Planning ahead and idea generation are two of the other areas of the brain involved in writing. And if we guide our students through brainstorming activities before they write, then they don't need to be doing their planning at the same time that they're actually writing. So this can, again, just help to reduce the number of tasks they're doing all at once. And we're going to spend more time talking about brainstorming and planning later. Concentration is another thing going on in their brains, and there are some things we can do to make this easier for them. One idea is to create these little privacy cubicles out of just two file folders taped together. So it kind of just gives them, you know, their own little space with no distractions. Another way that can help to focus students' minds is playing instrumental music while they're writing. So studies have shown that for many people, background music, instrumental background music, is effective at focusing our creative energy. So it's important, it has no words. And if it's clear that it's more of a distraction than anything else for most of your students, then obviously it's not helpful anymore. But almost certainly, some of your students are going to focus better with background music playing. And we spend all day catering to the ones who don't do as well with music playing, right? Like, we don't play music because it might distract them. But I think it's appropriate to have some times when we cater to the ones who do better when there's background music playing. And personally, I just find you know, soft classical music playing in the background lends such a lovely atmosphere to a writing class. Struggles with imagination and visualization is another neurological aspect that can cause a lot of trouble for students. So these are the Madisons of the world who have run out of words after half a page and look at you with desperation in their eyes when you ask them to just write a little more. They struggle to come up with creative ideas or maybe even any ideas at all. And before I go further into this, I want to be clear about something. There's a broad range of severity in this issue in our students. And there are times when you'll have a student in your class, you might have a student who struggles with this to the point that it is a learning disability. And that is more than you as a classroom teacher can take on yourself. There are some things we can do to help, but I think we also need to recognize our limitations in this area. As teachers, we sometimes have this idea that we personally should be able to solve every single problem our students have. And I just don't think that's true. I think teaching children is a community effort, right? And there are times when a child who really, really struggles with this is only going to be successful after some extensive one-on-one tutoring that you as a classroom teacher probably don't have time to give. And so when it comes to creative output, we need to remember that what it looks like for Madison to be a confident creative writer is not the same thing as what it looks like for Sophia to be a confident creative writer. We need to be okay with there being a range of abilities in this area. But all of that being said, there are some things we can do to help these students. So one really great way is to read through what they have, which is likely very bare bones and skimpy on details, and then just start asking them questions. So for example, if I had a student who had written, "The man walked into the house," I would ask the questions and try to help them add details. So what was the man's name? What did he look like? Is he tall or is he short? What color is his hair? What's he wearing? How old is he? Can you write two sentences right here telling me a bit more about the man? And then we'd move on to walked, and we say, okay, he walked, but how did he walk? Did he limp? Did he shuffle? Did he stride? Did he bound? Help them choose a more vivid verb for that word. And then we can move on to the house. Where is the house? What does it look like? Is it big or small? Is it a nice house or is it kind of run down? Does the house belong to the man? Can you write two more sentences right here telling me more about the house? And so just helping them to think about how they could add details, because often they can't go there themselves. They need you to help them think of those things. Another variation of that same process is just to choose a few key elements of what they have written so far and have them draw a picture of it, including as many details in their picture as they can. So for the example I just gave, I'd have the student just draw a little picture of the man walking into his house. And then they can look at their picture and write sentences describing the picture they just drew and the details they added. And for some reason, sometimes just changing the mode of their imagination to visual can be really helpful in breaking down that barrier. So, while none of these things we've talked about actually remove the need for this task to happen in the brain, we can diminish how much mental energy is going there and free up their brains to focus on fewer things. And all of those little things can be a big thing when it comes to helping our students write confidently and competently. Moving on to the next kind of broad category, fear or perfectionism. So these are the Lukes of the world who can stare at the blank page for the whole class period and not manage to write a single word. And I don't know about you, but I find these students incredibly frustrating, and I need to send up many, many prayers for patience from beside their desk, or else I'm not in a good frame of mind to help them. I used two words here, fear and perfectionism, to describe this issue, and there are probably times when it's one or the other, but I found that often these two are pretty closely linked. The fear of the blank page can be absolutely overwhelming to some kids, and I think it comes from too much pressure to create a perfect whatever they're trying to create. I've really been interested by this, but I teach writing to sixth grade, and it seems like by the time they get to me in grade six, they somehow have developed this idea that what they put on the page needs to be perfect. And then that's the same mindset that later when I'm asking them to revise and edit, well, they can't. Why would they? They've put it on the paper and it's done now, right? We're finished. And so then when they're thinking about it that way, it creates this incredible pressure to get it right the first time. So, and sometimes I do think, again, we can unintentionally reinforce this mindset in our students. So one thing is what we were talking about before with grammar and spelling. When we create an atmosphere of dotting every I and crossing every T perfectly in a rough draft, we can communicate that we expect perfection the first time. And so I've found just the simple practice of my students knowing they don't worry about grammar and spelling in their first draft, that alone has helped them just take the pressure off themselves on their first drafts. I will insert here, sometimes you might have one of those really perfectionist students who's going to be so bothered by the thought of possibly maybe having a spelling mistake that they simply can't move on. And so then again, if it's keeping them from writing, it's not actually helpful anymore, right? So you kind of have to take this on a student by student basis, but I've found it usually works to say something like this. You know, if you're not sure if it's spelled right or not, put a little question mark on top of it and keep going. You're telling yourself, you know this might not be quite right, but you're also reminding yourself that's not the most important thing right now. The most important thing is to keep writing. And then at the end of class, when you're all finished with your rough draft, you can bring it to me. I'll help you fix all your question marks, and then you can put it away. So it validates their need to get their mind off of it, because for some kids, it really does legitimately bother them. But it also reminds them that they should not stop the flow of writing just for a spelling question. So since we can so easily accidentally reinforce this mindset of rough drafts being perfect, I think we have to be really intentional in reversing that. I recently heard of a teacher who calls rough drafts a sloppy copy, and I just loved that. I was like, yes, exactly. Rough drafts are supposed to be messy. That's the point of a rough draft. That's what the rough part of the name implies. And so we need to keep reinforcing this idea that rough drafts are messy, rough drafts are imperfect. That's what we're actually trying to do in a rough draft. And one other way is actually through revision and feedback, which we're going to talk about in our next point. And actually, many of the ideas we're going to cover in our next point about how to structure our writing classes are actually going to connect back to this fear and perfectionism idea. We're going to talk about how to create a writing class culture that chips away at this terrible need to perform that can paralyze some students. Before we go to that, though, one other thing you can try for the student who just can't beat the big blank page is just folding their paper in halves or thirds. It's such a simple little thing, but sometimes that can be all it takes to get them over that hurdle. So, the third overarching issue then that keeps our students from being confident writers is sometimes us not giving them enough structure. So years ago, I used to do a lot of sentence starter sort of writing assignments where, you know, you give them the first sentence or maybe a general topic and then you just set them loose. And I still think there's a place for that, especially if it's a spare time activity. But if that's the only writing experience our students ever get, that open-endedness can be really difficult for some students and really overwhelming. You've maybe heard before that creativity flourishes best within boundaries, and I've certainly found that to be true in teaching children how to write. So I've personally moved away from sentence starter types of assignments, and instead I've found it works much better if I center my writing lesson around the writing process. So you've maybe seen charts like this before on Pinterest or Google Images, and if you're a free-spirited, artistic sort of writer yourself, you might kind of balk at the idea of condensing writing into a set of steps. But especially for students who are learning how to write well, putting structures like this in place breaks a complex task into manageable chunks. And instead of a chart like this, I personally like to think about it just in three stages. So we've got pre-writing, writing, and post-writing. So basically, what do we do before the students write, and then the students actually write, and then what do we do after they write? And there are lots of different names for the same thing here, so I'm going to kind of briefly explain what I mean by some of these words and categories, and then we'll go on and go into more detail on each one. So pre-writing is the instruction, and then the brainstorming or planning. So this is the stage where we want to set the framework for the writing assignment, start to get their creativity going, and also having them start to build a story in their mind before they ever even put pencil to paper. Writing, then, is the actual writing, so them actually writing their sloppy copy. And then post-writing is editing, revision, and feedback. So it's the student and we as teachers going back over what they wrote and making improvements to it. And this right here is some of the hard, gritty work of writing. But I think it's so essential in helping our students to learn how to write confidently. And we'll talk about why I think that in a little bit. But you can kind of think of this as sort of like building a house. So the pre-writing is the foundation on which the rest of the story is built. The writing of the rough draft is putting the framing in place, giving it the bare-bones structure it needs and that we can expand on later. And then the post-writing is finishing the house or the story with all the things that make it functional and beautiful. And just like if a carpenter would skip any one of those steps, his house is going to be missing something. Our students are going to tend to be shakier writers if any of these parts are missing from their writing experience. And I'll just insert here that depending on which curriculum you use, they might not have all three of these stages built into your lesson plan. And I hope that maybe by the end of this session, you'll have enough practical ideas that if that's the case for you, you can have good ways to insert some of this pre-writing or post-writing into what your curriculum already has. So let's zone in on pre-writing. This can take on many different forms, but the basic idea is we want to help our students create a foundation that can ground their actual writing. So in its simplest form, pre-writing is getting our students to think about what they're going to write before they actually write it. So if you're teaching a concept that you want them to include in their story, like foreshadowing or conflict or character development or using vivid verbs or whatever it may be, this would be where the lesson happens, the instruction on that thing. This would also be the time for one of my favorite ways to teach writing, using mentor texts. And if you're not familiar with the term mentor texts, it's simply using a book or a story or a poem as a guide for your students to write their own book or story or a poem. They kind of model it. And so the idea is, just like you can become an artist by imitating a great artist, you can become a writer by imitating great writers. And basically, it's a starting point. A chef starts by following recipes, but eventually they start creating their own. And we wouldn't want our students to stay there where they're always copying other people's work, but I think it's an appropriate support for where they're at. So a mentor text might be reading a sample from a chapter book that has lots of similes and metaphors to teach your students how to use similes and metaphors. It might be reading an example of the kind of assignment you're going to ask them to do. I love using children's books as mentor texts, and I'll just show you some examples of ones that I've used and how I've used them to give you an idea of what this might look like. So this is a book called The Three Little Wolves and the Big Bad Pig. And it's a terribly fun story, worth reading to your students just for the enjoyment factor alone. But basically, it flips the fairy tale, right? So the wolves are the good guys and the big bad pig is the bad guy. And so then I have them write their own flipped fairy tale. So they choose a fairy tale and they flip it around. So I've had students write about Little Red Riding Wolf, or about the wolf who cried boy, or the tortoise and the hare, but the hare is the one who's really hardworking and the tortoise is the one who's lazy. So they flip some element of it, and it's terribly fun. I don't know if you're familiar with the If You Give series. I think there's like 16 different books in this series, so there's lots and lots. Here's a few of them, though. If you give a moose a muffin, if you give a pig a pancake, if you give a dog a donut. And the basic idea, if you're not familiar with the stories, is it starts by saying, you know, if you give a pig a pancake, she's going to want maple syrup with it. And then she eats it, and she gets all sticky from the syrup. And so then she needs a bath. And one thing leads to another, which leads to another. And then what's really fun about these is at the end of the story, something happens that makes the pig really hungry for a pancake again. And so you're left with this feeling that the story could just keep going again and again and again in endless repetitions till the end of time. And so I have my students write their own version that does the same thing. These are a few more of my favorites. Diary of a Worm, Diary of a Spider, and Diary of a Fly. You could read any one of them. The three do actually connect with each other. So like the worm and the spider and the fly will show up in each other's stories because they're all friends. But basically it's diary entries from these insects' perspective. They're super fun and cute. And so I have my students choose their own animal or inanimate object and write the diary entry from that perspective. And so they might even do, you know, diary of my eraser. And they write about what if their eraser, the one in their desk that goes through whatever they put it through in a day, if that thing would write a diary entry, what would their entries sound like and look like? This book, Extra Yarn, is about a little girl who finds a box of yarn that never runs out, no matter how many things she knits with it. She always has a little bit of extra yarn. And so the elements I take from this book is just write a story that has a never-ending object in it. So I've had students write about the little girl who just couldn't stop eating vegetables, or a sponge that soaked up all the water in the whole world, or a spaghetti noodle that just kept going forever and ever and ever. And again, it's terribly fun to see what kids will come up with. They have fantastic imaginations. And so just a simple thing like that can be enough to get their minds going in a focused way, and yet still open-ended for them to have creative liberty. Windows by Julia Danos is this beautiful, imagery-rich, just descriptions of windows. This child walking through the town and seeing different windows lit up at night. And so I use this as an example of how we can write about an ordinary thing in an extraordinary way, in a beautiful, thoughtful way. Rudyard Kipling's Just So Stories are a fun mentor text. So these are like How the Whale Got His Throat, How the Camel Got His Hump, How the Elephant Got His Trunk. And basically, I'd have my students choose their own animal and write their own make-believe story of, you know, how the giraffe got such a long neck or whatever it may be. So those are some of my favorites, but you can use any book, really. Just ask yourself two questions. What's the thing about the story that I love? Or what's the thing that makes this story unique? And then take that thing and have your students piggyback off of it by writing their own version of that element of the story. So then, alongside with the instruction part, whether that's teaching them an actual concept or using a mentor text to show them where you're headed, another part of the pre-writing stage is doing some brainstorming or planning. And this right here is one of the best ways to beat the blank page. By giving them time and space to come up with some ideas before they actually start writing, it helps them in their writing once they get to that part, and it effectively removes the "but I don't know what to write about" problem, because hopefully by the end of your brainstorming, everyone has something on their brainstorming sheet. And that's a starting point, at least. Now, again, if any of you are writers, there may be some of you who are starting to feel a little uncomfortable inside because you don't like brainstorming and planning, and you don't do brainstorming and planning before you write. And I can certainly relate to feeling that way sometimes. Sometimes it feels like planning locks me down instead of freeing me up. And so it's very likely that some of our students actually feel the same way. It follows that in our classrooms, we'll have students who do better with brainstorming and planning and students who don't. But I would say that especially in children, the ones who don't brainstorm and plan and can still write well are definitely the exception, not the norm. Most students are going to benefit greatly from doing some initial brainstorming. So right along with that, though, I think it's just fine to give them freedom at times to choose whether or not they want to do some brainstorming. Teaching writing is equipping them with skills, but it's also giving them the chance to figure out what works for them. Writing is a very personal thing, and while there are things that work well for most people, it's never one size fits all. with writing because it comes out of who we are, and none of us are exactly the same. So it's okay to accommodate for that, I think. So brainstorming and planning could look very different depending on what you're teaching. So I'm going to show you just a whole bunch of different methods and examples that I use, and then you can tweak them to fit whatever your writing assignment may be. So I have copies of what I'm about to show you on the second page of your handout, and I made them small so I could fit a whole bunch on one page, but if you are interested in having a copy of any of these, feel free to email me. I have my email address on the bottom of the last page, and I'd be happy to send you digital files of any of these for you to use in your classroom. So the first one is something called a mind map, and a mind map can be used in many different ways. It can be used as actually a way to organize your thoughts. It can be used as a way to have them kind of summarize what they learned after a science lesson or something. But the basic idea of a mind map is you've got the central idea, and then you sort of visualize your trains of thought. So I'm thinking about this thing, and that makes me go over here, which makes me think of this, which makes me think of this, which makes me think of this. But, oh, I could also go this direction, which makes me think of this, and makes me think of this. Oh, and that actually connects to this over here. So you can draw an arrow connecting them, and you can draw little pictures, you can make it colorful. So that's a mind map, basically. So I'm going to let you have a chance to just practice here with a mind map. On the back of one of the sheets where you have a blank space, I'll just give you a couple minutes to play around with this, make your own mind map, and how about make a mind map with things you remember from this session so far. Just kind of a way to organize your thoughts of what you've been hearing in the past half hour. So go ahead, play around with that. So I'm going to break in here and interrupt your mind mapping, but hopefully that gave you a bit of a feel for how mind mapping could work. Another way you can do brainstorming, it can be very, very basic. So one lesson I do with my students is about appealing to all five senses in our writing to make it come alive. So make sure that they're mentioning sounds and sights and tastes and feelings and sounds. Did I say it? Whatever. There's five of them. You know the five. Okay. So we talk about how if we can mention those things in our writing, it just makes it come alive for the reader. So this is our brainstorming sheet. And before they start writing, they kind of know what the assignment's going to be. And before they start writing their story, they just like write ideas. What are sounds I could include in my story? What are tastes that I could write about? And once they have ideas on this sheet, it is far, far more likely that they'll actually show up in the story than if I would just give them a sheet of paper and say, write a story and make sure you include all five senses in your story. Because they've actually put thought into it. They've got ideas beforehand. So that might be what brainstorming looks like. Another way I do brainstorming sometimes is guiding them through a set of questions. So this is an assignment where they choose a unique perspective from which to tell the Christmas story. So maybe it's from the perspective of Joseph, or the perspective of the shepherds, or the donkey, or the manger, or whatever perspective they choose. And then you can see here, I just kind of take them through thinking about what it actually would have been like for that person or thing on the night Jesus was born. So what perspective are you telling your story from? What are some unique things that would have only been experienced through that perspective? So I try and really have them think about, you know, how can I make this a unique story because we're seeing it through the eyes of this person or thing. Another thing I really want them to bring out is what that character might have been thinking or feeling throughout the story. So I have them plan that. I have them think about that beforehand. What parts of the story would have been a big deal to your character? So for the donkey, maybe it was actually getting to the stable and finally not having to carry Mary anymore, right? But for the manger, it was the moment when Jesus was placed inside. That was the big deal. And so just thinking about that. And then we end by doing a quick write. And a quick write could be its own brainstorming technique all on its own, standalone. But basically in a quick write, I set a timer for, it could be anything. Usually I do about 3 or 4 minutes. And they are supposed to write as many things as they can until the timer rings. And their goal is that their pencil never stops moving. They're always getting thoughts out onto paper. And it doesn't have to be pretty, doesn't have to make sense, it doesn't have to be in any order. They're just getting any thoughts in their heads written down. And I tell them to, if you get stuck, just keep writing the last word again and again until a new idea comes to you. So it really encourages this idea of we're just getting things out of us and onto paper. And this one again just helps break the ice, I guess you could say, right? Like they've written something. They put some thoughts down, and so when you give them a new sheet of paper and set them loose on their story, it's not so scary anymore because they've already done a little bit of writing about it. Another way you can do brainstorming, this is an example too of sort of guiding them through a thinking process. So this is on a lesson of writing with unique voice, which is a bit more of an advanced idea. So depending what age you teach, this one might not be so applicable. But basically, writing in a unique way, that the way the words are said, the way the story is told is fresh and original. And so I kind of have them think through, and you can sort of see here the different things. I get them to think through different ways you can do that. So by being funny, sarcastic, ridiculous, overly descriptive, big long word user, word inventor, you know, one of those things could help you create unique voice. So choose one and play around with it on your brainstorming sheet. And then we move on to using out of the ordinary words. Come up with some out of the ordinary words that maybe your narrator could say. Could you have a word or phrase you keep using repeatedly? That's another way you can create voice. Or could you give a character or the narrator a unique way of talking? Maybe it's an accent, or maybe it's just the way they say things is unique. So I have them kind of just explore, play around, experiment with what feels fun to them. And then out of all the things that they write on this sheet, they just choose one, maybe two, that they use in their story. So that's something else I really emphasize with students for brainstorming, is that just because you write it on your brainstorming paper does not mean you have to use it in your story. And we actually want brainstorming to be more ideas than we can actually use. And yeah, because then you can just choose the ones you like best, right? And I also tell them, if an idea comes to your mind that you don't like, still write it down. Because getting it on paper can make it stop taking up space in your brain, and then you'll have room in your brain for a really awesome idea. So again, this pushes against the perfectionist, fearful students, well, this is a dumb idea, and then they get stuck on it, and they just sit there. Well, no, you write it down, and then it's gone from your brain, and you have space for an idea you like better. And that can really help them sometimes. And so we want to push against this idea of nice, pristine, perfect brainstorming. That's not what brainstorming is. Brainstorming is messy and wild and all over the place, and that's okay and that's good. This right here is probably the method of brainstorming I fall back on the most, and it's called a bubble map. How many of you are familiar with bubble maps already? So they can also be used like as an organizational strategy, which is what this example would be, right? They're organizing different sports. But it's kind of like a mind map where you branch off of your, you know, you sort of have ideas and then you have sub-ideas, and maybe you have sub-ideas off the sub-ideas if you keep going that far. But instead of drawing lines, you draw bubbles coming out of sticks. And one thing, this is random, but one thing I love about bubble maps is if your students are familiar with them already, if you're teaching them how to outline, this is a perfect way to show them what an outline is. And so it takes something familiar and helps them ease from the familiar into the unfamiliar of an outline. So, you know, your center bubble would be your topic, and then your next set of bubbles would be your Roman numerals, and then your next set would be your A's and B's, then your next set would be your 1's, 2's, and 3's, and it just can really help them kind of make some of those connections. But back to using it as a brainstorming tool. Again, I'm going to let you play around with this one. So go ahead and make a bubble map with ideas you have had during this session of things you can do in your writing classes. So any ideas you have of things that you can incorporate. All right, again, I'll interrupt you and we'll keep going here. So once the pre-writing stage is done, then you can move on to the actual writing. So this is where all the stuff we talked about before comes into play. You know, try to minimize handwriting difficulties. Don't let them get hung up on grammar and spelling. Ask them questions if they're stuck, and encourage them to let it be messy and imperfect. And then comes post-writing. And this is the part that I more and more strongly believe we don't spend enough time on, generally speaking, and we don't spend enough energy on it, and it's having a direct impact on how our students view their writing and how they view themselves as writers. I don't think we'd ever let our kids go through a whole year of school without ever opening the math answer key to check if they're doing their math right or wrong. And yet, if we stop after writing a rough draft and never go any further, we're kind of doing the same thing. How can we expect them to get better at something if they never know what they're doing wrong or how they could do things better, how they could improve on what they're doing? So moving on to editing and revising. Now, sometimes we can use these words interchangeably, but they're actually two different things. So editing has to do with making changes to capitalization, punctuation, and grammar. So it's kind of the mechanical side of things. And then revision is making changes to thoughts and wording to improve the quality of the thoughts and the quality of the writing. And too often when we tell students to revise their work, they just edit it and stop there. Because editing is easier. Editing is more concrete. Editing has a black and white. There should or should not be a comma here. This is how you spell this word. Revising is much more difficult, right? Because there's no black and white, there's no clear rights or wrongs. It's just you yourself needing to look at it and say, how can I make this better? How can I choose a better word? Should this sentence actually be up here? Should this sentence not be here at all, right? It's more nebulous and it's just harder for our students. So editing is more concrete, but learning to revise well is a really essential part to learning to write well. So we want to put energy into making sure our students are revising, not just editing their work, especially in an era when word processors can offer mostly accurate suggestions on grammar and spelling, right? It's becoming less and less of an absolutely essential thing. It's still important, don't get me wrong. But if they're typing on a computer, spelling's not actually going to be much of an issue. So, So I just think it's much more important that students learn to revise their work to make it stronger, and that writing class should be the place where we focus on building those skills. Because we already spend hours and hours focusing on grammar and spelling, right? We have grammar class, we have spelling class. We need a place where they can learn this other stuff, right? This place to learn how to improve their thoughts and their wording. And here's an idea for you to consider. Maybe sometimes we as teachers should not even correct their grammar and spelling on some assignments. There is nothing more disheartening to a child than writing something they feel proud of and getting it back covered with red marks because they missed a comma here or a capital letter here or they spelled a word wrong there. If we want our students to feel excited about writing and feel confident about their writing, it's really important that we don't promote the idea that it's only good enough for us as teachers if they have every word spelled perfectly and every piece of punctuation perfectly in place. So I suggest you have some assignments that need to be edited precisely and that you will grade for that. But also give them space to hand in assignments that are going to be graded for the writing's sake, not the grammar and spelling. So one way to do that is actually just to focus on one aspect of editing each week or each writing class. So this helps make editing intentional, yet manageable. It's not so overwhelming, you know, not all of it at once. So then, so maybe it's this week you're focusing on putting a capital letter at the beginning of each sentence. That's what I want you to look for. That's what I want you to edit for. You don't have to focus on the rest of editing. Work on revising, but don't spend time on editing the rest of it. And then incorrect grammar and spelling won't result in points being deducted, except for that one focus area for that week. You might disagree with me here, and that's totally okay. You don't need to agree with my philosophy on this to be doing it right. But I do just encourage you to think about any potential ramifications of whatever you are requiring. So how do we teach students how to revise their work? Because it is so difficult, right? One way, I think, is just showing them examples. Putting an example up on your screen or handing it to them of a piece that has been revised. It's got red marks all over it, and sentences are moved, and words are stroked out, and sentences are added. Just actually showing them, this is what it looks like. Or it can be fun to put one up on the chalkboard, and as a class, you do it together, right? So what do you guys think? How can we make this better? And I take red chalk, and I mark that thing all up, and we keep doing it until it looks like an absolute mess. And then I tell them, that's what your story should look like once we're done revising. And they all look a little horrified. But it shows them, right, that this is actually what becoming a better writer looks like. It's hard work, but this is what all writers do. No writer just pops it out perfectly the first time. Another way that can work well for showing them how to revise is revision guides. So this is the third sheet of your handout, but again, they're small. I don't know which is small, so the one on your sheet or the one up here. So look off whatever one is easier for you. But this would be one example. So basically I make a rubric, kind of, but it's a very child-friendly, fun. You can see I kind of tried to say things in a conversational way. And it's, you know, frowny face, flat face, or smiley face. And so then I have them think through the different aspects I wanted them to include in their story. So underline every verb you can find. How many of them are vivid verbs? So we would have been working on vivid verbs in our story. Does your story make sense as a continuation of the first line? So another thing that would have been a part of this assignment is having a strong first line and then developing the story from there. And then the other thing I wanted them to have clearly was a problem and a solution. So I have them check. Is there a compelling problem? Is there a satisfying solution to the problem? And then I'd have them check that they met my length requirement for this story. And then you can see the bottom one is, did you use quotation marks when someone was speaking? So that's my editing focus for the week. That's the one part of grammar I want them to focus on. The rest of their time should be spent on revising and fixing up their thoughts and their wording. What's really nice about this sort of thing, if you put the time into making it, is then you basically have your grading rubric right there. Tweak it a little bit, attach numbers to it instead of smiley faces and frowny faces, and it's kind of outlining the important things I wanted them to work on in this assignment, and so it's also my grading rubric with a few minor changes. So you can kind of double up on your work there, which is always a good thing. They do not have to be that intense. Sometimes I just do a checklist. So this would be for the assignment I was talking about with the five senses. So I have them check, did they do that? Is their story at least a page long? Do they have punctuation at the end of each sentence? And if they put an X anywhere, have they gone back and fixed the problem in their story? So pretty basic, just a little checklist. I sometimes do one like this. So this is for the story we talked about before, writing the Christmas story from a unique perspective. So again, I kind of ask them these questions, and some of them are the exact same questions I had on the brainstorming sheet, basically. So did you actually do it once you started writing? Did you do the thing you were supposed to do? And they rate themselves as a yes, a kind of, or a no. And then again at the bottom, I say, if you have any kind of or no's, you need to go back and fix it. Go back and make it better. So then after students have revised their work, the last important aspect of post-writing is feedback of some sort. So this is, you know, the idea of we take out the answer key for math and we put check marks or X's so that they know how they did. So ideally, the student will receive feedback both of what they did well and what they could improve on. And I know how utterly overwhelming this feels as a teacher, right? Writing assignments take a long time to grade. And especially if you take the time to write helpful comments on every single one, this can take hours. So how can we make this less work for you? One way is to use a symbol system. So, you know, symbols take like 1 second to draw. So my students know when they get a piece back from me, if there's a smiley face, it means it made me laugh. If there's a heart, it means that I really liked that line. It was really well written. Good job there. And if there's a star, it means I have an idea of how they can improve it. And then I put time in my writing classes for what we call teacher conferences, and they come up to my desk and we talk one-on-one and I give them feedback in person during writing class. And also they can ask me any questions they have. So I find this uses my time more efficiently and it makes the feedback more personal for them too because it's in person. And I often have these times during a class period when they're writing their second drafts That way everybody else is busy while I'm meeting with individual students. So if it's possible for you to insert space sometime in your week for one-on-one conversations about their writing, whether that's in silent reading time or homework period or whatever works for you, I really encourage you to do it. It'll save you time in the long run because it means this feedback is happening during school hours instead of after school hours, right? And it also goes a long way toward helping students take ownership of their work. And with greater ownership comes greater confidence of their writing. But I also know how precious time can be in the classroom. And so if you just can't make this work, it's not like it's the only way to give meaningful feedback. Another way to take some of the weight off your shoulders is by having them give feedback to each other. So maybe that's putting them in pairs or small groups and letting them read each other's drafts and offer suggestions, or actually trading rough drafts and writing notes, or making a practice of reading their writing aloud to the class, and when they're done, people say compliments or suggestions for improvement. And we need to be really careful here because one unkind comment can destroy a writer's confidence in seconds. So I always take a lot of time to talk about this with my students at the beginning of the year. We talk about how vulnerable it is to share our writing with others and how we need to treat others the way we would want to be treated. We talk about how to phrase suggestions kindly, even doing some role-playing of good and bad ways to offer suggestions. Often I'll put sentence starters on the board like these while students are responding to each other's work. So it gives them a framework for how to offer constructive criticism in a kind way. And especially depending on the age of your students, they might not even know yet what is a kind way and what isn't. So they just need to be trained and taught what is a good way to do this and what is a hurtful way to do this. And we also talk about how at the end of the day, the author gets the final say. So they absolutely do not need to incorporate all of the changes that are given to them by someone else. And that too gives them ownership of their writing, gives them ownership of their work, makes them feel more confident in what they've created. So, zooming out a bit, I've become a firm believer that grounding our students in this process of pre-writing, writing, and post-writing is a great way to improve both the quality of their writing, but also their confidence as writers. And zooming out even more, when we can recognize these overlying issues of lack of structure, fear, and perfectionism, and the neurological difficulty of writing, then we can help, or we have what we need to start building targeted solutions for these problems. But of course, it isn't magic. Writing is a complex, difficult, wonderful thing, and it can just take a lot of hard work from us and from our students. To keep growing in it, to keep getting better at it. But I fully believe it is worth investing in. Writing is about shaping our students' minds to think differently, and that's an important work. Pam Allen says, "Living a writing life is living with our eyes wide open." When we turn our children into confident writers, we're teaching them to see well and to say well, and that is a gift that our students desperately need. Thank you for being here this morning. We have a bit of time for questions. Are there any burning questions you would like to ask, or comments, or pushback, or ideas you have? I would love if we could learn from each other here too, things you've done that have worked.
How long is your classes?
That's a good question. Yes, I do two classes a week is how I found it works best. And our first one is pretty long. I try to go at least 45 minutes. I like 50 or 55 better. I know it's kind of a long time, but, and then we do the pre-writing and the writing on the first day. And then the second day is shorter, it's about half an hour, and that's when we do our post-writing. So our revision and our feedback happens on the second day. I do find it works best if you can keep the pre-writing and the writing on the same day. Because if you teach them the concept and let them brainstorm and get all excited, and then you wait a while before they actually write it, they lose all of that wonderful momentum that they built.
Do you use a curriculum or do you have one you recommend?
I have quite a few questions. Like, I have a list here and I'm politely waiting for you.
You know, that's a really good question. I kind of have just built my own thing because I love writing, and so that's how I roll. But I really should have a list. There's a book called On Writing Well by Ruth Colham that I've found really helpful to help me in thinking about it.
Okay.
But I think there are a couple in the bookstore, like a couple writing curriculums that
I think I just bought that book this morning.
Oh.
I think
good
so.
Good work.
I
really like that one.
Do you use composition books?
I have developed a binder system.
Okay.
So they have tabs for their revision guides and brainstorming sheets.
That's nice.
But books can work too. Yeah.
How about writing every other line?
Yes.
You do that?
Yes. In rough drafts, we always write every other line because then there's room to revise. There's room to go through and make it messy.
So my writing, I use IEW, so it's really structured.
Yes.
I'm a creative person, so I don't always love it. But in their work, so in language or in history and Living Threads, they often have like a paragraph that they need to write about maybe a person that they need to write about. Especially on their tests, they freeze because I'm going to mark something. So how do I do, like you're talking about rough drafts, you know, hey, you can just brainstorm. I tend to approach it in that way on their test as well. I won't, especially spelling and that kind of thing, I'm not bumping that. But I have a couple students that are perfectionists, for sure, and just freeze.
And that's so tough because once they're in that mode, it's so hard to get them out of it, right? Once they're stuck and panicking, it is almost impossible. So one really practical thing is just to get them like physically and mentally and neurologically out of that panic state is they just actually have to get up, go get a drink, and then come back. Sometimes that can help just like snap them out of it. But yeah, I think brainstorming, even for those sorts of things, is great, right? Because it helps them collect their thoughts before they're actually writing.
And on a test in particular, would you do that with the whole class? I'm kind of asking about something different, I think.
Well, that's okay.
Like
I think I would probably tend to let them do it individually, their own brainstorming.
Yeah.
And if they're familiar with a mind map or a bubble map, then that could just be their go-to, right?
Yeah.
Make a bubble map.
Yeah.
Once you feel like you're ready to write, write your answer. Yeah. Okay, well, I'm going to let you go if you want to go, because time is up. But if you'd like to hang around and ask questions, I never get tired of talking about writing, so I'm here. Thank you again for being here.
Do you teach more grades than the sixth grade writing?
This year, no.
Are you a home teacher?
This year, no.
Okay. So
I was for years.
I guess my question is how many hours a week are you putting into this? Because I feel for myself, there's so many other things that are more demanding for me that writing is like intense.
Yeah.
Especially with the feedback.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so that's just going to depend on your unique situation, right? I really value writing and teaching writing. Like, I think it's so, so important, and I think we don't spend enough time doing it in general. So I would tend to prioritize it more, I guess. As far as how much time I spend per week, it's kind of hard because I've had some established stuff for a few years now, so it's hard to remember what it was like when I was working on it. But it does take a lot of work to get something initially there.
So the way I've been doing it is we have a very short class and then they write it whenever. And a few days. And I'm not sure if that's the best. Last year I did the thing where we would just have 35 minutes or so to write. And I got frustrated with people just sitting there. And if I tell people, just move on, you can do it at home or something like that, it seems like it gets done. So.
Well, yeah, and absolutely. Like, you have to figure out what works for your specific students, because every child is going to be different, and so I think find what works and then do that. Yeah, but yeah, I do too. Like, if when they're writing, I am always on the lookout for kids who are sitting still, and when I pick them out and then I'll check the clock. I'll literally check the clock and they get a minute to sit and think. And if there's still stuff after a minute, I go over, I read what they have, and I just start asking a few questions. Usually that's enough to get them going again. This year I have one who that's enough to get him going for 5 more minutes and then he gets stuck again. So I go back and I ask some more questions and it really does help him get out of that rut. But probably there are kids out there that that wouldn't work for, and then I don't know what you do. Pray.
I do, a co-teacher said, and I got this idea from her, was, or maybe it was somebody at a teacher event, the thing of having your students write throughout the week in journal entries to get them so once the creative writing assignment comes around, it's not as overwhelming. This really helps me. So I'll put like a picture up on the board and say, write 7-sentence story about what you see. Or,
yes,
you know, like you, those books you can buy, that 400 writing prompts,
right,
type of thing. So I do that and I don't really grade that. It's,
yes,
just their extra time stuff.
Yeah.
But do you have ideas on more things you can do throughout the week that doesn't get graded, just to get them like more thoughts on that or things you do?
So there's a couple writing games I love to play with my students that are fun if you have like spare, you know, those awkward 10-minute chunks where you're like, oh, we are done with history and what are we going to do next or whatever. So one is they start writing and you have a timer and they start writing whatever they want to, and every, I don't know, 45 seconds to a minute, when the timer goes, I say someone's name and they say the last word that they wrote. So maybe they just wrote the word hippo. Now everyone else has to use the word hippo in their story before the timer rings again. And when the timer rings again, then I call the next student and they just wrote the word pumpkin. So now everybody else has to include a pumpkin in their story. So it's kind of, it helps them be flexible in their thinking and it's just fun. You know, and someone comes up with some weird word and everybody gets all dramatic about it because now they have to try and figure out how to use it. You know how kids are, but it's a fun one. So things like that. Writing, and if you go online and look up writing games, you could find more ideas there, I'm sure. The other thing that, especially if you feel like you don't have enough time in your week to teach writing, like maybe you don't even have a dedicated writing class slot. I know in some schools that's just the reality of it. You have so much other stuff to cover. But we can incorporate writing into all subjects, even math, even art. You can have them do a writing assignment as a response to what you learned. So history, it's writing a diary entry from the perspective of this person we were learning about, or this explorer is writing a letter home to his family, what would he write about, or, you know, things like that. Or, you know, in math, you can get them to write, it's called a process analysis, where you, like, it's a how-to, basically. So, you know, if you do a process analysis of how to make a sandwich, you're supposed to make the steps really clear. Get them to do a process analysis of the concept you just learned. Super fascinating, because you can see, you can read, here's what you do first, here's what you do second, and those students who are struggling, you can go, oh, that's why they're struggling, because they're doing this and this in the wrong order, or whatever. So that's a way to incorporate it into math, or you could do fun things like the negative numbers are mad at the positive numbers and write about the fight that they're having, or, you know, whatever you want to do. Art, you can do lots of like responding to art, kind of like you were saying with putting a picture up and having them write about the picture. So having them respond to art or show them a famous work of art and then have them pretend they're one of the people in the painting and what's it like from their perspective. Or, so I just think if we're creative about it, we can actually include writing all through the week through all the subjects. It doesn't have to be just something we do in writing class. It can be something we do all the time. And I love the idea of students writing every day, mm-hmm, just that's what they do. Writing is part of what school means.
Thank you.
Yes, you're welcome. Thanks for being here.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call us at 814-789-4769. Recordings from past events are also available at www.thedocforlearning.com.